This is Structured Rambling, a podcast about ideas from literature and about literature. Episodes can focus on a single text or a theme from multiple texts. My name is Paul Sonsby. Welcome. You've probably heard the quote from Winston Churchill, "Those that fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it." Eminently quotable, Churchill. An early king of the soundbite. But for my money, this is defeated by an earlier statement by German philosopher Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. We learn from history that we do not learn from history. This episode was inspired by a recent writing assignment I gave to my students. I asked them to write about someone who is dead that they would like to meet and tell us why. There were a lot of grandparents mentioned, Michael Jackson, Eddie Van Halen, but a handful, I mean more than one or two, mentioned Adolf Hitler. I was momentarily taken aback. I'm not even a religious person, and I wrote down Jesus. Hitler? Really? You think that would be a worthwhile experience? One of them said he knows Hitler was an awful man, but he'd like to hear, quote, his side. We know his side, I said. The kid attested we know the American side. He did not mention the British or Russians or Canadians, this Albertan kid. I forgave him. I tried to engage with his ideas without belittling him. I mean, there's Mein Kampf and, you know, the war itself. The young man said we only know what the victors told us, which is a valid interpretation of any part of history, but not exactly a fair assessment of the Führer's career. Now, this was a little while ago, but it's been eating away at me. Maybe because this summer I reread William Shirer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, the definitive history of the Nazis' role in the war in the West. But another thing to consider is this kid's argument was generational. I can vaguely recall in my earliest memories as a very small kid, Remembrance Day ceremonies in the very early 1980s, there being one or two veterans of the First World War. My grandparents' generation fought the Second World War. The current generation of youth is growing up without connection to almost anyone who served in one of Canada's three great 20th century conflicts, the two world wars, and Korea. All of the First World War vets are gone. Most of the Second World War are, and the Korean ones will be gone soon too. Yes, these kids learn from history, but for them the events are much more distant because they are the first generation to not have personal connection to the people who fought in these wars. That creates an instant detachment. The people who fought in these wars still referred to events like Dieppe and the Battle of the Bulge as one time in their life current events. And that kind of touchstone from people who actually experienced the events by connection, those of us who encounter it get sort of a reciprocal current events, if that makes sense. Growing up, I knew it was a foregone conclusion that the Second World War, the greatest cataclysm of all history, was important. However, I was also ignorant enough to strictly see it in terms of good and evil, which no war is. War, by definition, is not good guys and bad guys. Even a war in which Hitler and Stalin were involved has greater subtlety than post-war propaganda and rewriting of history can present it. World War II ended 78 years ago. That's multiple generations. It is very important to know, but not in the minute details of your Saturday morning armchair historians. If you're going to try to tell a young person why knowing about World War II matters, you need to make sort of some broad statements. And for this, I'm outlining today what I feel are the main things a kid who's learning about World War II for the first time needs to know. You can spend your entire life dedicated to the history of that 6 years. You'll never know it all. What do you have to know as a functional human being in 2023 about World War II? Because you do have to know something. This isn't just, you know, singular obsession. This is, sadly, the most important event to happen to our world in the past 100 years, maybe ever. Most of what came from World War II was bad. Not quite all of it. Mostly what little good came out of it were things like the United Nations, confrontation of tyranny and racism in the years to follow. And these are something we haven't completely achieved yet. And frankly, in some ways, we've taken some quick backward steps, some giant backward steps. However, World War II, to be understood fully, needs to be remembered for what we call it, the second one, the sequel. Because World War II wouldn't have happened, at least in Europe, had it not been for World War I. And this is the first thing I think, quote, kids these days should know. World War I should never have happened. But it was going to because everyone wanted it to. The big dogs, especially Britain and Germany, had built up their armies and navies and were looking for a reason to flex them. You don't build up an army without looking to use it. It's the old adage that when you have a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. When I used to teach social studies classes and I would introduce World War I, I'd always talk about the two big guys at a party eyeing each other up from opposite corners. Eventually, they're going to want to test their strength against each other. The tough guy always has to see if he's the toughest. The problem with World War I, well, no, there were many. But a big problem with World War I was the ending. Germany blinked first, looked to surrender, and received terms. France and England, equally responsible with Germany for the travesty that was the Great War, they called it at the time, they had no intention of being nice and performed the great screw job of the Treaty of Versailles in 1919. Germany was broken up, disarmed, forced to pay reparations, and blamed for everything. This was wrong. World War I was caused by belligerents on both sides, and Germany, in the end, took the blame. Was forced to take the blame. In its way, Germany ended the war. In its way, the Treaty of Versailles kept it going 20 years later. A very proud nation was allowed to fester in resentment at this unfair treatment, and the right kind of hatred could be sort of aimed by the right kind of person. Enter Adolf Hitler and his party of sadistic bullies. No Versailles, no Hitler, no Nazis. Maybe no Second World War. I say maybe because Hitler, rightfully maligned as the greatest villain of the 20th century, was hardly alone as a militant dictator. So the second thing we got to talk about when we talk about World War II is the tyranny of the leaders, the Axis especially, but even at times the Allies. I've often wondered how things got to be where somebody like Hitler and his inner circle, how Mussolini and the Japanese military rulers could take and retain power, leading their nations down such dark paths. A big justification, at least in the West, might be the rise of another tyrant, Stalin. Coming out of World War I, many ruling families, which had been the norm for centuries, simply ceased to exist. The Habsburgs, the Tsars of Russia, even the German aristocracy were made meaningless, and some of them were outright killed. You lived in a country that had always had a king, a single figurehead, a ruler, and now you had something confusing and, depending where you were, only partially democratic at best. What happened in Russia, a revolution that saw a violent overthrow of the upper class, scared the world. So many people died, and despite calling itself socialism, when the dust settled, you had tyranny under Joseph Stalin, who was responsible for the deaths of more Ukrainians and regular Russians than the Nazis would be of Jews. Bolshevism scared the world, and the other tyrants, especially Hitler, weaponized it. This might seem strange to those of us raised in democracies, but the people in 1919, as the flames of war died, but those of the Russian Revolution and purges roared on, Bolshevism would have been a far more frightening unknown than a king. Very few countries in the West were pure democracies. Even little Canada's constitutional monarchy pledged allegiance just to the king. We still do. Most living generations in most countries, except for France and the United States, were raised under some kind of monarchy. And if it was, a sort of democracy like Britain, the ruling class still provided the political leaders. People were used to having people rule them. Communism in action saw powerful thugs overturn that rule. It looked like chaos. To your common person, having a single powerful ruler would have made a lot more sense and appeared a lot more traditional than whatever these things that were going on in other places. This may be why we moderns can understand and accept the acceptance of a Führer or a Duce, because a single powerful ruler was more the devil you know to these people. Hitler would exploit this, pointing pretty much from the beginning as what he saw as the tandem of Bolshevism and Jewry, like undermining the German state. Japan had a military regime, and once into the war, even the Western democracies rallied around a single man with unprecedented power. Consider Roosevelt and his four terms of office. As the war dragged on, these massive personalities and their inflated egos saw to the deaths of hundreds of thousands. The Second World War was worse than the first for these arrogant and ignorant petty rulers to order the deaths of thousands, because after the first, we were supposed to know better. The absolute horror of Stalingrad was the result of a pissing contest between two megalomaniacs. But this sort of arrogance was on both sides. It was everywhere. The island of Sicily became a moment of posturing between the Americans and the British, particularly their two all-star generals, Patton and Montgomery. Rather than work together, these two blowhards competed for fame on this island, which allowed the Germans enough time to escape and led to a protracted and brutal fight in Italy. D-Day was first off to appease Stalin, and Stalin was busy racing the Allies to Berlin. In fact, Stalin pitted his own generals against each other so that they could try to win fame, making it to Berlin first. Churchill, Goering, MacArthur, on and on the list of absolute arrogant wasters of life goes. From Hitler down, this war was about massive ego and individuals insisting on the deaths of thousands for their own personal pride. And that waste of human life is another reason we got to study this war. Before I even get to the Holocaust, let's consider the military waste of human life. World War I was such a fool's errand because those in charge insisted on trying the same thing over and over again for years, no matter how badly it was working. But World War II saw much of the same thing on a much grander scale. The famous American Battle of Iwo Jima saw American Marines take thousands of losses for an island of almost no military importance. Once committed, they couldn't back away, and so wave after wave of young men were thrown at Japanese caves, entrenched positions, to win an island that mattered not at all. That famous photo of the flag raising ignores the cost, but suffice to say that three of the men in that photo didn't survive the battle of that island. For us Canadians, a sure example of the useless waste of human life is Dieppe, a British thought-out Canadian-executed raid on Nazi-occupied France. The whole thing was a debacle, a useless test that cost lives and led to prisoners and proved nothing except that France was fortified by the Nazis. In civilian terms, this war was the worst ever and inspired levels of terror on the regular populace never seen before, though it continues to inspire today. First and foremost, amongst those wars on the civilians was, of course, the Holocaust. But it's not the only horror perpetuated by either side. It's just a story altogether on its own within this war. Every time I think about the Holocaust, I have to stop and think about the Holocaust. Even if you think you get it, you don't. And I'm talking to myself. The scope of murdering 6 million Jews and political prisoners and the disabled, homosexuals, gypsies, it's beyond one's capability to grasp. 6 million people. You just can't. We ask how, forgetting that Hitler's scapegoating of the Jews, blaming them for World War I's losses and being in cahoots with the communists, was just old-fashioned, traditional anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism in Europe is older than Europe. Mass exportations, ghettoizations, labeling, the Nazis just took it a step further. Racism was endemic all over the planet at the time, and in many places still is. All the Nazis did, and I don't want to understate it, but I also don't want to understate the fact that racism is common everywhere and was at the time, but all the Nazis did was turn it into executions. There's no time here for trying to parse the psychology of genocide, but let's have it said that this sort of active punishment of civilians and active employment of racism were not unique to the Nazis. They just did it and lost, which means that they couldn't hide it. Stalin starved millions of Ukrainians. The British bombed Berlin. The Americans firebombed Tokyo. The British napalmed the city of Dresden. Americans and Germans executed prisoners of war at the Battle of the Bulge. Hiroshima, Nagasaki. This war legitimized making war on the people instead of the people's army, and we've been there ever since. American and Canadian depictions of the Japanese as rats, as monkeys, as subhumans are no different than the German depictions of the Jews. In Canada and in the United States, we forcibly removed Japanese descendants, many of whom didn't even speak Japanese or have any contact with the country of their heritage. We concentrated them in camps ourselves. We took their property. We didn't give it back. We treated them like subhumans. No, we didn't murder them. Aren't we noble? The Nazis' final solution is only the most diabolical and infamous atrocity carried out on the record in World War II on regular people. What we need to learn from this is the wrong in passively allowing our leaders to do this to us. What Hitler and Mussolini and Stalin set out to prove, and ironically, what the Allies proved in retaliation against Hitler and Mussolini, is might makes right. Strength proves the point. And that's war. And that's another thing we need to learn from this war. the pointlessness of war is the point. The pointlessness of proving anything by force. I always say it's the equivalent of one monkey hitting another monkey over the head in order to take his bananas. Even mechanized, even nuclear, it's our most basic stupidity, war is. Now, I'm not saying there appears to have been another solution to dealing with Hitler once 1939 rolled around. He wanted war and he was going to have it. Or at least, he thought he could keep bullying Britain long enough to win a war against Russia first. But the world got there. The world got Hitler and Stalin. Let's remember, because of the pointlessness of the last war and how it was solved. Because war solves nothing. It creates more problems. World War I caused World War II. World War II caused the Cold War. And you can trace the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the horrors Hamas and Israel are performing in Gaza back to this. That's my next point. War solves nothing. It just creates more war. You know what else does that? Cancer. Hitler and Mussolini were bullying fascists who believed that having strength gave you the right. They were brought down by strength, and millions of helpless people were slaughtered by them and the other side just to do it. The egos and arrogance of a small group of men pushed it on. And that's why I get so mad at moderns. Despite the ground we've covered, despite lessons we've learned, there are still those who feel being strong or being able to win a fight gives you some sort of right and ability over others. Despite the horrors perpetuated on Jews, Japanese, expatriates, Ukrainians, homosexuals, mentally and physically, racism and bigotry have never died. They are still used as a justification for hate. The current horrors being perpetuated in Gaza show we still really cling to the need to fight a war for religion. Our oldest cause for war, after the excuse of just taking people's stuff. This episode was inspired by a conversation with my students, bright people, good people. I know more about history than them. I'm older than them. I've lived triple the years, read triple the books, watched triple the movies. I was born only 30 years after the Second World War ended. Those veterans, those kids never met, were only a little older than me now when I was born. We can't expect these kids to know all about the war. Like Napoleon in Rome, eventually things fade into just history. But there are still those things we should recall. The rise of tyranny, the justification that might makes right, politicians denying fact and twisting through misinformation and propaganda, the pure, wasteful unproductivity of war. How world events and millions of deaths are governed by the egos of a small group of small-minded and arrogant men. War taken on the innocent. That is how war is conducted now. It is taken on the innocent. These are the things we need to remember. War serves no purpose. There is no such thing as a just war. War, in its nature and by its definition, is unjust. All acts in war are war crimes because war is organized, mechanized, legalized murder. Even this war, World War II, which history tries to tell us was exclusively a war against evil, to say that ignores the Allies getting in bed with Joseph Stalin, a man who was every bit the equal in evil to Hitler. It ignores Dresden. It ignores Stalingrad, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. There is no just war. There's just war. And the reason we must learn the truth about war is so from history we may someday learn enough to create a generation that may not be dumb enough to be doomed to repeat it. So I've ended where I began. With the things the so-called kids these days need to still learn about World War II. Speaking as someone who is daily invested in what they learn. But I end in defense of why they learn it differently. As I said earlier, this is the first generation to grow up with no contact with World War II veterans. All of them, all those vets are almost gone. And yes, that means a loss of stories and a loss of some of the most stoic and inspiring people who ever lived. The greatest generation, with two capital G's. But when the people lived, care always had to be given in how we discussed this war. Their actions and losses, losses of friends and their youth and their innocence, had to be justified. They had to have stood for something. We couldn't just say it was waste. The needed purpose. Arm's length allows us to see war for what it really is. It is human nature to justify things, even something as unjustifiable as war, any war. Maybe we succeed this time. Maybe the generation that comes of age as Ukraine and Gaza burn will be the first to say, but actually mean the words, never again. I want to thank you for listening today. And if you enjoyed my podcast, please feel free to give me a rating and review. Episodes come out at the beginning and middle of pretty much every month. Have a great day.